You have these sisters living in temples, and they dedicate their entire life.
Yeah, but
their
when
youth,
they're adults
beauty.
And do it, it's okay because they chose it themselves. But to raise a child from the get-go in a monastery, in a temple, in a masjid, and deprive them of all the childhood experiences,
playing
and talking and making
running
a mess,
around.
Yeah, barefoot
in
the grass.
You never know, you know. These pages of history are dark to us.
They very much
us.
Are.
And we don't know anything about
exactly.
them. Perhaps, you know, these were like complexes. It wasn't like one single room, you know, that kids wouldn't... Actually, kids at that time, they weren't like kids in our time.
Mm.
Their dolls were like one piece of stick of
True.
Wood.
And eyes carved in them.
Exactly. So their childhood at that time, centuries ago, were...
Simplistic.
Not even comparable to what we do for our children. You know,
True.
We buy sets of toys, clothes, furniture for our children that they don't even use them.
Yeah, exactly.
And we spoil them. And the outcome of our child raising is not so fruitful in our time. So it's not like what we're doing is the best and what they did was catastrophic.
Mm.
So I think that probably Lady Mariam, when she was 2, 3, 4, 5, she ran around, she had her own playtime, you know, she had her own childish games going on.
But I do think that they were all exceptions of history. Now, no one like Mariam is ever going to happen again. No one like Fatima al-Zahra, no one like Zainab al-Kubra. No one. Come on. Be honest. Can you imagine any woman, any other, Sayyidah Fatima, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, she said after her father's demise, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, that if the calamities that befell me during this time befell upon the day, it would turn into night.
Mm.
She was an exception.
Yeah, but still you can find so many people. You know, when you are placed in the heart of a challenging situation, God gives you the power.
Mm.
Of course, maybe not exactly. You wouldn't turn out like, say, the Fatima salamullah alayha, but you have extraordinary powers reserved within you. A human being has the potential, has the capability. Seriously, I believe in this. These days, all these positive thinking ladies who are going on Instagram, they're just giving you positive vibes every single morning and telling you that the impossible can be made possible if you believe and if you work towards it.
Mm.
Yeah. So this is just with the materialistic approach, they're, you know, trying to prove what they're saying is right. But in the spiritual realm, the same story holds valid. And I really think that the spirit of human being has the potential to reach its full capacity if there's a will.
Exactly. Which basically means that we all have this potential, our souls, our nafs, whether to do good or do bad. But we're going to go on a short break and we're going to be right back. So don't go anywhere.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Muslim Lady here on IRIB English Radio. We're here in the studio with my darling sister Razia Shamili, and we're discussing Ashura'i women and Ashura'in women. We were talking about, in brief, some women in history that I personally think are just exceptions of humanity. But, you know, that's the job of our show. We take exceptions. We take
rare cases.
Yeah, rare cases. And exactly. Try to dissect them and find certain factors in them that we can apply to our own lives.
Exactly.
And we're going to try to focus our attention on the movement of Abu Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi salam and how it was preserved and continued by a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And how we can...
A woman or women?
Women led by a woman, you know? And Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam also being protected by a woman. Like, you know, Sayyidah Zainab, she just played a very, like, hardcore heroine... awesome role.
I know. At the end of the day, you, like, the only lady that you can find so much to talk about is Lady Zainab.
I know.
But also, before delving into the heart of history and talking about these ladies, I kept thinking about one specific lady today, which is in our own time, not so long ago.
Interesting.
She was martyred. Mm-hmm. She was born in Iraq, I think in the city of Qadamain, and born in a very noble family, a scholarly family. Her brother was also a martyr.
Mm-hmm. Okay, all right.
I think you can guess what her name is.
Yeah.
What's her name?
Bintul Huda,
exactly.
As-Sadr.
Exactly.
I think her given name was Amina, though, wasn't
it? Yeah.
And that she was a remarkable woman.
Yeah.
She was an author as well. She
exactly.
was a writer.
Exactly.
She'd write short stories
exactly.
for women.
Exactly.
I think I've read a few of her books. She has a very somber, very mellow, warm sort of pen.
Mm.
And she was brave. She was brave. Like with a capital B.
So she's an exceptional woman as well. One of those exceptional women that we cannot really compare ourselves with.
Yes and no.
Why yes and no?
Yes, in the sense that she was a sadr. She was born and weaned and raised in a scholarly family, like
of
you said.
As-Sadr.
Of the sadrs. Right? I'm not saying all the sadrs are like
awesome
exceptional,
people.
Awesome people. But still, come on. Nurture is a factor. Upbringing, nurture,
there are
family,
so
environment.
Many innumerable factors, but you have to take a holistic approach when you're talking about a human being. I was just, things come in between. I was also reading about this other lady and her story in supporting the ambassador of Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about...
her name was...
Tawa.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Right? So Toa was a lady in the city of Kufa, and she was the wife of Usaid Khazrami and the mother of a dude called Bilal.
Uh-huh.
And then Muslim ibn Aqil was in Kufa. It was nightfall. Everybody had rejected him. Prior in the morning, hundreds of people were behind, supporting him and telling him, yeah, we're with Imam Hussein. They had actually sent letters to Imam Hussein.
And they pledged their allegiance.
They pledged their allegiance. And by nightfall, they all...
revolted against him.
They just changed their mind and they...
they were paid off.
They just left.
Yep.
And he was all alone in the alleys of the city of Kufa. And the only person who came and, you know... took him to her house was this lady, Tawa.
Mm.
And her son was this Bilal who reported them to the forces of Ibn Ziyad, and then the lady and Muslim ibn Aqil were both martyred on the 8th of Zilhijjah. You were talking about being raised in a noble family. You see, of course, there is a very strong relationship between by whom you are raised up.
For sure.
And whose blood
runs
in your veins. But this is not the only story.
Absolutely.
This lady, Tawa, was the mother of Bilal, who reported them to Ibn Ziyad.
Mm.
So, as you know, you're saying, yeah, these are the Sadr family, you know, and they're exceptional. And it's like, it makes it a little harder for you if you are raised in a non-godly family,
exactly.
But it's
not... that's what I meant. That's what I meant by yes and no. On one hand, she already had the groundwork. On the other hand, well, obviously, she had her potential. She could have, you know, had different inclinations, but she didn't. We have so many freedom fighters and brave figures and personalities, say, in Palestine, from totally normal families, but they fight for justice, they fight against oppression, they fight for their people, they're brave men and women.
Or that Italian rich guy, millionaire, who was martyred, who became a Shia.
Eduardo
Agnelli.
Mm.
You see, he was the son of Ford company.
Owner.
Owners. And then he became to be a true Shiite, and, you know, the story about him.
Exactly. So the point is that there are a lot of components at play, like you said, and it doesn't necessarily depend on one single factor. But in any case, the objective of our show, the series of show we're going to have on this topic, is to try to apply all these factors into our lives and see how we can work about it and navigate toward the direction of getting close to those standards we set up for ourselves, i.e. those exceptional women in history, right? Because if you want to set standards for yourself, obviously the standard has to be higher than you.
Mm.
That's all the time we have for today's episode. Thank you for being with us. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Who is the love one?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. Is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes, so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
an... The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asl zinde ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by famous Iranian Shiite orator and lecturer, Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
تمام شؤون امامت الان برپاس برقرار شما همتون میدونید شبای قدر
مقدم. The position of imamat is active in all its dimensions now, but how and through whom? The answer is Imam al-Mahdi. You might have heard that on the night of Qadr or the night of power during the month of Ramadan, the destiny and fate of many believing people for the next upcoming year is ordained. This means that what's going to happen to the believing people for the upcoming year is given by Allah to the angels and by them to the Imam of the age, who is Imam al-Mahdi. This means that Imam al-Mahdi is still active and he is doing well, his missions ordered to him by Allah. One of his greatest missions is conveying the graces of Allah to the believing people during the night of Qadr, and these graces could be health or wealth. As we have in the narrations, no angel of Allah will come down unless he goes to the door of Imam al-Mahdi ajalallah. Now, one of the tributes of the infallibles, including Imam al-Mahdi, is that they are like a crossroad for the angels to pass by. Therefore, Imam al-Mahdi is doing his duties well and is well supported by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Fi amanillah.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام أثقل ما يوضع في الميزان يوم القيامة الصلاة على محمد وعلى أهل بيته.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "The heaviest thing to be placed on the scales on the day of resurrection is the invocation of blessings on Muhammad and his household."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, the divinely appointed Imam, has some very beautiful conversations and some very beautiful dialogues in which he talks with his companions and his friends, his relatives, his family, and to the Muslims in general. He talks to them about these beautiful conducts of life, these secrets of life, which truly will help us on an individual level, but will also help us on a societal level and a global level. These kind of Islamic, perhaps you could call etiquettes, but really they are Islamic methods of living your own life as an individual in order to protect yourself and in order to help you develop and grow spiritually. In one of these conversations, when asked about whose advice should someone get, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam replies to his companion that one should ask the advice of those who fear Allah. Once again, dear friends, one should ask the advice of those who fear Allah. Now, this is a very beautiful statement. It is quite profound when you start to reflect and contemplate about it, right? So, for example, let's say you take the advice of somebody who only is concerned about the materialistic world. So you ask them, should I pray my prayers or should I make $1 million? Now, the individual who purely has a materialistic view, a person who only considers the materialistic wealth of the world to be important, of course will say, hey, you need to take that $1 million. And on the other hand, if you have somebody who really values power and position and status, right? If you ask this kind of an individual, well, should I go for the promotion or should I keep my beard? Now, this person who considers wealth and power and position and status and right, these things to be important, of course they're going to tell you, hey, go ahead, shave your beard, but take that promotion. Now, what if we do what Imam al-Baqir says? And he says to take the advice of those who fear Allah, fear disobeying Allah. This individual will tell you, don't take the $1 million. Pray your 2 rakat namaz. Pray your prayers, for they are more valuable in this world and the next when compared to the $1 million, which won't even last. And when you ask a person who fears Allah, should I shave off my beard or should I take that promotion? They will tell you, do not disobey Allah. If for the sake of Allah you lose your promotion, it is Allah who will give you a promotion 100 times better than this. So, dear friends, ask the advice of those who fear Allah. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Even when it comes to the concern for the mu'mineen among ourselves, Imam, there is a statement by some of the historians that among Banu Hashim those days, Imam was financially weak compared to other members of Banu Hashim. But even then, he would go out of his way to be concerned about Banu Hashim and the other mu'mineen and members in the community. A person by the name of Hassan bin Kathir, he went through some difficulty in his own lifetime, went to the friends. You know, he was affluent before, but things change. With affluence, you have friends. When the affluence is gone, it's as if you have influenza. Nobody wants to get even close to you. And this was the situation of this fellow by the name of Hassan bin Kathir. He goes and complains to our fifth Imam and he says, you know, the friends that I had, when I was okay, they were good. Now that I'm in need, nobody wants to really even approach me. فَتَعَثَّرَ عَلَيْهِ السَّلَامِ Imam became, you know, it impacted on him. When he heard about the akhlaq, the bad akhlaq of some of the individuals in the community. And he says, بِئْسَ الْأَخْ يَرْعَاكَ غَنِيًّا وَيَقْطَعُكَ فَقِيرًا The worst of the brothers are those who are concerned about you, or they respect you when you are affluent, and then they cut ties when you are faqir. And then he ordered his own slave to bring a bag of money which had 700 dirham. And he gave it to Hassan bin Kathir and he says, you know, use this. Once you run out of this and you still need more, then let me know about it.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Couple of scholars who came with the new ideas, who came with the better principles, and when they came up with those principles and better ideas, how to extract something out of the statement that we have, or what are the principles? Mirza Naini is one of those scholars.
It must be indicated that amongst the publications and works of the late Ayatollah Mirza Manat Hussein Gharavi Naini, his book Tanbih al-Ummah wa Tanzih al-Millah is very significant.
Surely we've wronged ourselves, what will we say in front of him?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the All-Beneficent, the All-Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is the teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. I have two guest speakers for my today's discussion in the program. The teacher, Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhruhani, and Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi. Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhruhani, a faculty member of the University of Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you.
You're welcome. And Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi, an Islamic scholar from the Islamic House of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to your show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
So, Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhruhani, let's start with you, brother. In our previous discussion, we talked about Mirza Naini's ideas and his researches regarding Usul al-Fiqh and Fiqh, and we said that the important point and the significant point which made him different from the other scholars of his time was the component of his political thought, which were deeply rooted in his, we can say, Islamic and religious thought. In one of the speeches and the textbooks, he defines the political participation as the pillar of the Islamic government. Also, he says that the ideal Islamic government is based on consultation, and freedom and equality was one of the slogans of the constitutional revolution in Iran. And he defended all of these principles. And what is important is that he was anti-despotic, anti-colonialism and imperialism of his time. I think he had quite enough characteristics and features of becoming a leader of a freedom movement, what we call in the 21st century for today's discussion. Talk a little bit about this aspect of the life of Mirza Naini for us, his political thoughts.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa nasta'in. In this regard, it must be indicated that one of the important, I should like to say, instructive aspects of Shi'i seminaries, I mean, no matter where they may be, whether in India, in Iran, in Iraq, or elsewhere, or nowadays, for example, in Lebanon, okay, one of the educative aspects is that, okay, they tried to redefine the political thought within the framework of Shi'i religiosity and Shi'i religious standards.
That's right.
In order to do this, first of all, they tried to take lessons from the early Islamic history, okay, mainly from the, I mean, the life of and the seerah, I mean words and deeds of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, as well as the around a 5-year government or administration of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Personally, I believe the life and times of all the infallible imams are replete with many points and many lessons from which political thought can be reframed or can be deduced.
That's right.
Okay. In this regard, it must be indicated, first of all, in the today political or geopolitical thought, okay, there's the concept of transnationality, mm-hmm. and transnationality has got many definitions. I believe that the late Amir Zainaini wasn't a man of thinking about Islamic transnationality. No, he was a man of thinking about Islamic transreligiosity. Okay? Mm-hmm. When he defines, in his book, Tanbih al-Ummah, when he, comes to discuss, characteristics of the, political framework or political scenario of such a country like Iran, he never, makes any distinction between, for example, Sunnis and Shiis, in contrast to, for example, Christians or Zoroastrians, Jews, and some other people. When it comes to discuss, political framework of a new and at that time, emerging government in Iran, he talks about in Persia at that time.
That's right.
When he comes to talk about this, okay, he draws a very broad map in this regard, okay, and within this map, okay, all ethnic groups, all, for example, followers or minorities, all of them are included, okay? He wouldn't say, he never said that, okay, for example, this right is specifically, applied to or used for, Shiis in contrast to Sunnis or Christians in contrast to Zoroastrians and so on, okay? From this, we understand that what I should like to refer to as Shi Islamic transreligiosity, it must make, something, it must be quite, implicit, not only explicitly stated, but it can be deduced from the gist of the sociopolitical thought of the late Emir Zainaini.
That's right.
However, there was one point, the remainder knew one point. The point was that at that time, the Qajar dynasty over there, in Persia, they were really very despotic, and they never recognized any right for people,
that's right,
even for the courtiers, to express themselves. Whatever might be the whim of a king or monarch over there, it was the rule. In fact, the king referred himself as the rule in the whole nation.
That's all right.
The late Naini came forward and drafted his book, Tanbih al-Ummah, in order to say that, okay, it wasn't the right way of, managing the affairs of a nation, okay? But at the same time, we find that, when he drafted his book, he wrote his book, in Persian, and it was first published in Baghdad, followed by subsequent reprint editions elsewhere, and even in Arabic translation. We find that in his book, he defended the right of the nation in order to have an assembly or a parliament, in order to discuss important issues. Mm-hmm. But in order for the laws, phrased over there, not to be against or in contrast to Islamic religious ideas, teachings, and instructions, it was necessary for at least five great mujtahids to be present over there. However, it was, it's a reality that I should like to say that not after the, after the emergence of the constitutional movement, but somewhat, before the coming up of the constitutional movement, some agents of Western powers, made themselves or crept into the movement, and little by little they made a digression.
That's right, digression.
It wasn't,
the constitutional revolution was diverted
It was diverted on purpose, Mir Zainaini couldn't anticipate this. As a scholar, he developed his book, like any scholar, for example, even in the social science. No, take, for example, mathematics, take geometry.
I know what you mean, okay.
And a scholar writes his book, but it isn't his responsibility if his ideas, ideals, and teachings might be misapplied.
That's why maybe he regretted writing this book.
Yes.
But we'll get to this book more. Nice introduction, a nice background you gave us about the political thoughts of Mir Zainaini. But Said Mohsen Naghvi, for an alim, and a scholar, a religious scholar, Marjai Taghli, the religious authority on that time, of this high caliber of understanding, we can say, also knowing about the political thoughts of his time, and also being concerned with the socio-political atmosphere of his time, seems a little bit to be rare on that time. But Mir Zainaini was a different case, isn't it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Since we live in a secular atmosphere
now
environment, and our studies are all based on the secular thoughts, you know, whatever we learn, because, you know, we learn to earn money. Mm-hmm. We study in order to have a good job.
That's right.
We do not study for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes.
We don't study for our own selves to become a better human being or to become a perfect person. No. Our aim to study is to, you know, either become a doctor, because doctors have a, you know, high, we can say, like,
salary. That's right.
Or maybe the economist, or maybe a professor, or I don't know. There are different fields. We study for this world. That's why we cannot think of a religious person being involved in the politics.
That's all right.
Whereas the original Islamic studies, we mentioned this, that everything is within Islam, the politics, economics, I don't know, the social affairs, the ethics. Everything is within Islam. Quran is talking about everything. The Prophet has talked about everything. Islam has everything within it.
That's all right.
It's not separate from Islam. So if a scholar is being active in a political, we can say, like, field or economical field, it's not something far from, you know, the imaginations.
That's right.
Why? Because I can just give you a couple of examples. You know, the father of medicine, the father of, I don't know, differences like geometry.
Yes.
We see they all were the Muslim scholars.
Mm-hmm.
These were the scholars. We can see the buildings.
The golden age of Islam, that's right.
Yeah. The buildings that were built in Isfahan, we're talking about Isfahan very much, like he's from Isfahan. They were made by the Muslim scholars.
Yes, sir.
Like Sheikh Bahai was there. The other scholars were there at the time of Qajar even. So the scholars itself, like, obviously, because we have everything within Islam, that's why they were active as well. About the political activities of Mirza Naini, I just want to mention one part which is missed in this discussion, is that when the First World War in 1914, it was started, England took almost most of the parts of the Iraqi land.
Okay.
And when this happened during that World War One, the Shia ulama, all of them, they raised against it, and they gave the fatwa of jihad to the people of Iraq. And therefore, the people of Iraq, because they were the followers, especially, you know, the southern part of it, which is like, we can say, like Kufa, Najaf, Karbala, and all those, these were the Shia parts. They fought against it, but obviously they couldn't obviously fight against the British government of that time. So they were deceived by the British government, and British government took over the rulership of the whole Iraq. And after that, Mirza Naini was also involved in those ulamas.
That's right.
Who gave fatwa against it, who were very much active against these people.
That's all right.
After they got the control of Iraq, the British government, they announced, like, the people should vote for one of the Britishers to become the president or the in charge of the whole Iraqi, we can say, state. Over there, again, we see that Sheikh Naini, Mirza Naini, and other ulamas, they stood against this decision.
That's all
and
right.
They gave a fatwa. They said, a kafir, a disbeliever, cannot become a ruler of
the Muslim land. That's right.
And when this happened, the England was deceived by this, you know, rulings that were issued by the Shia scholars, especially it was the time of, we can say, like, Mirza Naini and Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani.
That's all right.
Both of them. And after this fatwa, England brought Sheikh Faisal as a ruler of Iraqi people.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, they asked him to have an election. Even that time, they stood against, because he was the representative of the disbelievers. So the Najaf and Karbala did not participate in the elections. So when this all things happened, the British government pressurized the, you know, Sheikh Faisal, and they expelled the Sheikh Naini and Mirza Naini and Ayatollah Abul Hassan Isfahani, both of them, to Iran.
That's right.
So when they came to Iran, they have a big, you know, welcoming.
That's right.
Over here, a warm welcoming.
Okay.
But on the other hand, the Shia ulama, they pressurized Sheikh Faisal. And in 1342 Hijri, it was the time when Sheikh Faisal apologized from these two big scholars.
Yes.
And they asked them to come back to Najaf. Mm. And that was the time when they came back to Najaf. So in their political life, we can see, like, they were very much active. Why? Because, you know, when you study Islam, in Islam, the rulership is for God, and that is the main theme. Like, we are monotheists. We believe in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And whoever he appoints as an authority, that person becomes the authority. That's we cannot right. accept. And that's why, you know, our dear guest has Dr. referred Mona to the yes, right. he referred to the book which he wrote, and that also shows purely like
yes.
what is the basic, we can say, rulings and the ideas of a ruler or the government yes. in Islam. Basically.
Very good. And and that book we are talking about, Tanbihul Ummah wa Tanzihul Millah, we can say informing the nation and purifying the religion, the most outstanding book of Mirza Naini, has attracted the thoughts of not only the researchers of his time, but the following generations of how a Muslim alim or a scholar, a religious authority, an ayatollah, can write a book about Islam, which is applicable also in the sociopolitical scene of his era and his time. And this is very important. Inshallah, we will dedicate our next session of the program to this book, specifically Tanbihul Ummah wa Tanzihul Millah, compiled by Mirza Naini. But thank you very much, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, for your presence in this program. And Dr. Mohammad Reza Fakhr Rouhani, thank you very much, brother.
Thank you. You're welcome.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher on Call of Islam Radio. Visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page, also our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all, fi amanillah.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Families and friends were overjoyed at London Heathrow Airport on Monday, 2nd of August, after a travel route change meant they could reunite after 18 months of pandemic separation. Very, very excited. It means the world, said Sue Blake, as she waited to greet her son, daughter-in-law, and grandson, who had flown in from New York and who she last saw 2 years ago. It's a big chunk of his life, and I'm so thrilled for him that he can come here, she said of the 8-year-old. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Reuters News Agency journalists Guy Falconbridge, Ben Macquarie, and Sarah Young. The piece is titled It Means the World: Families and Friends Reunite at UK's Heathrow. Stay with us for more. Families and friends were overjoyed at London's Heathrow Airport on Monday, 2nd of August, after a travel route change meant they could reunite after 18 months of pandemic separation. Very, very excited, it means the world, said Sue Blake, as she waited to greet her son, daughter-in-law, and grandson, who had flown in from New York and who she last saw 2 years ago. It's a big chunk of his life, and I'm so thrilled for him that he can come here, she said of her 8-year-old grandson. Watching the hugs and tears in the arrivals hall, Heathrow Airport's boss urged Britain to remove barriers to travel, not add to them, amid speculation that the government was poised to impose more rules. Let's just make it easier now for people to travel, Heathrow Airport's chief executive, John Holland Kay, told Reuters. Britain, where the death toll from the coronavirus pandemic has nearly reached 130,000, reopened its borders to large parts of the world on Monday, scrapping quarantine for fully vaccinated arrivals from the European Union, excluding France and the United States. The reopening of the borders was welcomed by families divided by the pandemic and airlines strained by it. It is really awesome, said 31-year-old medical writer Colleen Castro, after collecting her luggage. She and her husband had come to London to deliver some happy news to his parents. It's been a really long time, and actually, I'm pregnant with my in-law's first grandchild, so it's really exciting to finally be able to be here and share that news with them. For travellers from Britain's closest neighbour, France, who must still quarantine on arrival in Britain due to London's concern over COVID-19, the opening up for other countries stung. It's a bit scandalous for the French, said Alain Jourdain, just before he boarded a Eurostar train from Paris to London, where he will need to spend 10 days in isolation in order to see his children. He last saw them back in 2019. It is very complicated, in particular all the paperwork to fill for the UK government. And it could get even more complicated. The travel industry now faces a new headache, with the government set to issue a COVID-19 warning against holidays to Spain, according to the Times newspaper. We just need to keep things simple. We need to build confidence in travel, Heathrow's chief executive, John Holland Kay, said when asked about the reports of another rule change. Britain has one of the fastest vaccination programs in the world, but the government has prevented the travel industry from bouncing back because of its maze of rules and track record for making last-minute changes. Spain could go on a new category of risk, the Amber Watch List, meaning it could be upgraded to red at short notice, with arrivals from Spain having to quarantine in hotels. Meanwhile, Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson said on Monday, 2nd of August, that he wanted to get the travel industry moving again with a simple user-friendly system to allow for trips abroad without importing new variants of the coronavirus.
More than 15 million American renters are at risk of eviction without backup as abandoned residential evictions expired on Saturday at midnight. Early Sunday, some Democratic lawmakers rallied outside the Capitol to call for the ban's reinstatement. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention ordered the moratorium to fight the spread of the COVID-19 and prevent homelessness during the pandemic. It came into effect in September 2020 and has been extended multiple times. The U.S. Congress had approved around $47 billion in rental relief to states during the pandemic, but the money has been slow to make it into the hands of those in need. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said only $3 billion out of the total allocated fund has been distributed to renters. Pelosi and other top Democrats have urged the administration of Joe Biden to extend the moratorium through October the 18th. The U.S. President Joe Biden is under fire by his own party members. The Democrats criticized Biden's inaction as the deadline neared, some furious that he called on Congress to provide a last-minute solution to protect renters. Biden had asked Congress to extend the deadline on Thursday amid the surging Delta variant, but Congress failed to act after Republican House members blocked a Democratic-led bid. The House has already left for a six-week summer recess, and it remains unclear whether the administration could extend the moratorium using executive powers.
It's a partisan issue. There's absolutely no difficulty with the United States providing the money to their own citizens to enable them to pay their rental commitments. And it's something I argued back in March of 2020, where it's absolutely necessary because if you're going to fight the virus, you have to enable people to stay at home. If they stay at home, they can't earn an income, so they must be given a cash flow to cover their outgoings, so you don't get people being made homeless courtesy of fighting a pandemic.
Pressure is mounting on U.S. lawmakers to extend a moratorium that barred landlords from evicting certain tenants who could not pay rent during the pandemic. This put millions of Americans at risk of being homeless amid the coronavirus pandemic. Meanwhile, top U.S. infectious disease expert Anthony Fauci has warned that the coronavirus situation in the United States is set to get worse as the country grapples with a surge in the Delta variant of the COVID-19. The U.S. is currently the worst-hit nation by the pandemic. Homeless Americans could face other challenges as well. For instance, Los Angeles has approved a new law that makes it illegal for unhoused people to be in almost all places across the city. If you become homeless in LA, that's the fair fate that awaits you. That's why the latest city count shows LA has over 66,000 homeless people.
And it shows the extent to which the American political system uses its own people as a bargaining chip or a shuttlecock in this battle between the two ruling parties. So it's utterly unnecessary and it'll be very damaging. And again, it's a sign of just how divided America is these days that this is being allowed to happen.
The expiration of the U.S. eviction ban could send millions of people out on the streets. Then they're faced with the threat of the coronavirus and hunger. Currently, around 40 million low-income Americans rely on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program to stay out of hunger. It seems the U.S. politicians are more interested in spending money on wars and U.S. military bases and adventures around the world instead of their own people.